Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to Filibuster here on the Nerd Party Network. This week, me and Dallas are celebrating a huge moment in the recovery of the cinema industry as No Time to Die, one of the first big names to be postponed early last year due to COVID-19, has finally arrived in cinemas. With huge box office numbers across the world, and with America finally getting the film later this week, we dive into a big spoiler discussion about Daniel Craig's fifth and final James Bond movie. So Dallas, can you believe it? It's finally happened.
COVID is over. It's official. I mean, this was the first film which moved, wasn't it? I think back in, I guess, late February, early March. I think was it meant to be April at that point?
April, yeah. The tickets went on sale in March.
Yeah, oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'd actually booked my ticket, and then like the day after they went, actually, we're pulling it to October. October 2020. Yeah, so I mean, I think even up until I was in my seat and the credits started, I was still like, is this a real film? Is this going to happen? But I'm certainly glad I did. And it certainly looks like UK cinemas are glad it did as well.
Yeah, most definitely. It's crazy to think. Like, I remembered even at the time where it was one of the first big films to really be postponed, and I remember people talking about, oh, they just want to delay, the film's not very good, or there was like rumors that, oh, it's actually gonna be about a bioterrorist, so they feel it's an uncomfortable time to release it. And I even remember when it was due to come out in October, I was so confident even then it was going to come out, because I was like, they've just started releasing the official podcast, they've released the first episode, that's got to be a sign that James Bond's coming out. And then I remember going to the film house to see some film or another, I can't remember what it was, and then coming out of it to the news that it had been delayed again until sort of like April time, kind of later this 2021. I was like, oh my god. So I was like you, I just couldn't believe it was finally here. And I think I said it in our last episode, I was officially confident it was coming out when it finally started getting added to the bus stops.
Yeah, it's weird to think that it's taken so long. And it was a worry, I think, that would people still be interested in this film, you know, given it has been so long, not only waiting for about 2 years for it to be released, because I think its initial date was sort of like October, November 2019, you know, would people still care, you know, given that it's now been, it's about 6 years since Spectre, but I think the results at the UK box office are a resounding yes, people still care. People still want to get to the cinema to see Bond. And I know the Broccolis were like, we're going to wait until 2022 before we start the search for the next Bond. And I'm like, no, just get on with it now. Get them cast, get them into production, because you never know what's going to happen. You know, the other person might have aged out by the time the film starts rolling.
I think the moment I knew this film was going to be a success with audiences was, I think the film came out officially on Wednesday. It was Thursday.
Wednesday night, yeah. If you could muster a midnight screening. So.
And I got a call from my grandmother about like 8 o'clock on Thursday evening. She called to ask me what I thought of the movie, and she let me know that she was going to go see it with my cousin at the cinema he was going to drive. And she does not go to the cinema at all, but you know, this 75-year-old plus woman is going to go to the cinema to watch the new James Bond movie, because that's kind of what we do here in the UK. We queue and we go see James Bond films. Two things that are constant as a Northern Star with us.
Yeah, it was. I was like keeping track of the Belmonts. The manager at the Belmont, Colin. I mean, he noticed like a huge spike in bookings once the following the premiere in the rave reviews that it was getting. Like, people were still slightly skeptical. You know, oh, am I going to go? I mean, my parents who have not been to the cinema since they reopened back in May, they've got the tickets booked and will have seen it by the time this one drops. So that's going to make for an interesting text message, I'm sure, when they get out of the cinema. But we'll get into that in a bit, I imagine.
Yeah, so I'm curious to establish, Erlang, because we've never really done a James Bond episode before. What kind of James Bond fan are you, and what were your hype levels for this film specifically going in?
I mean, I am a fan of the films. I mean, Bond for me always feels like, you know, he's a very British you know, tradition. And for me, James Bond is probably equivalent to Doctor Who in many ways, I think, in that everyone has their own Bond. You know, they could have a favourite Bond, but they've also got the Bond that they grew up with, that they were first introduced to. So I think my original Bond would have probably been Roger Moore, I think. I think it was probably around about, I think the first ones I probably sort of saw around about your sort of Octopussy and Moonraker ones. They're probably not the best ones to start off with, something the most out there and fantastical. But then, you know, you'd go back and start watching the Connery ones. And then, but I think I think my favourite Bond is probably GoldenEye. I think that was probably the first one that I saw in the cinema, actually. So, you know, that has a huge effect on me. Then, you know, the other ones maybe got a little bit silly. And then we got into the Bourne movies, which put a greater edge on spy stuff, which was reflected when Daniel Craig took over the Casino Royale. But I've been a fan of Craig's reinterpretation of the character. I like the fact that it went back to the beginning and we could see the evolution of this character. His films have been hit or miss, you know, not always to their own fault. I know that Quantum of Solace suffered from a writer's strike and stuff. It was like, we have to go ahead with the film now. We're not going to be able to make it at all. You know, he seems to be doing it's an inverse Star Trek, I guess, in the fact that every odd one is good and every even number one is bad. Skyfall, I was a big fan of it. I wasn't as enthusiastic as everyone else. For me, Casino Royale is still my favourite Craig Bond. Spectre was just a film, but, you know, I was excited to see where this one goes. You know, I would have argued that the end of Spectre was, it did tie up Bond's character's journey at that stage, but, you know, Daniel Craig himself said that he wasn't entirely happy with Spectre and wanted another shot. So, but I think this one definitely gives him the closure that he was looking for. But overall, I've been a big fan of Craig's series. I think the directors they brought in have been able to deliver spectacle. I think they've been able to deliver a deeper characterization of Bond. And I mean, we'll get onto it in this one, but his journey, the evolution of the character in terms of where he starts off and where he ends up was nice to see. And also, you know, growing with the times that he's in terms of certain aspects of his character and stuff like that. And yeah, so I was excited to see. I mean, it wasn't my number one film that I was most excited for this year. That's still June. But I was looking forward to seeing it. And also, you know, the greater ramifications of the success of a film like this can have as well. So yeah, I mean, you are the number one Bond fan on the podcast, so I mean, how were you how have you managed to cope with the last sort of 18 months? I mean, I think the only time we've really talked about Bond was about 3 years ago, when I think we were hypothesizing what a Danny Boyle Bond film was going to look like. And yeah, how out of date was that?
Yeah, and we'll certainly be talking about kind of Danny Boyle later on, but yeah, I was really, really looking forward to this movie. I think it was one of those things, James Bond movies, when they get released, fall under like a rare category of film where when I watch them for the first time, my experience isn't one where I just sit back in the back of, you know, maybe like a Marvel movie, for example, where I kick back in my seat and I just sort of let these sorts of things wash over me. You know, I don't necessarily have an emotional connection to Marvel as a thing outside of watching these movies. But with Bond, things like Star Trek, for example, I watch these films and it's like, from the first second, I'm like, oh, that's an interesting choice. Or, oh, I noticed they did something slightly different with the gun barrel there. And, you know, it's just things like that where it's just like you're processing all the decisions and thinking about it as a James Bond motion picture. And you always need to go see it a second time. I might get the chance to go see it tomorrow, but it'll probably maybe when I'm back from the London Film Festival before I get a second shot. Maybe even I might go see it in the BFI IMAX down there. But it's one of those ones, it's just an overwhelming experience watching these films, you know, good, bad, there's just a lot going on, and you come out of it going, huh, okay, right, start to process it. And you would need to go back almost to watch it as like a normal person the second time without overthinking it, overanalyzing it, you know, even putting extra pressure and going, well, those opening credits weren't that great. You know, there's about 20 other different opening credits that are better than that. I mean, that isn't a normal way to watch a film and process a film. So you almost kind of need to go through that process first to then come out on the other side and go, I want to see it again. And yeah, I went to see it as a midnight IMAX showing. You know, I had a little bit of a nap before seeing it. Didn't get to bed till 4 and had a long day afterwards. But I was really glad that I went to see it that way. I've never had the chance to see a Bond movie in IMAX. It's never a Bond movie at midnight before. They've never done that sort of thing before. They've done simultaneous screenings, but it's always been a sort of traditional day and day release sort of thing for cinema. So yeah, there was a lot of hype going in for me, but you know, it's impossible not to touch on Spectre, where I remember seeing that for the first time and I had a different reaction. I came out and went like, yeah, that's good. But I was lying to myself, and I saw it a couple of days later and I was like, oh, that just wasn't that good. I loved Skyfall. I actually think it's probably one of the best James Bond movies. It's what I want from a James Bond movie, which is a little bit niche in a way. It's not always what people want out of a Bond movie. I like the idea that it started big and got smaller and smaller and smaller and more intimate, and it was very UK based and it was very personal, intimate. You know, sometimes that's the type of Bond movies I like, you know, that Casino Royale, License to Kill, Living Daylights, you know, those type of James Bond movies where it's like small scale, the scope is very much tight, as opposed to End of the World, you know, international terrorism, all these sorts of things where it just gets a little bit too big and it just becomes almost a little bit silly, which is fine in James Bond movies. I enjoy those movies, but those aren't my personal preferences. And when you've made 25 movies, you can really be picky and specific about what you like, what maybe you don't like, but you can still enjoy a large, huge amount of that 25.
Yeah, I think just remembering now, one of my biggest issues with Spectre was the whole Star Trek Into Darkness sort of play that they made, and that Christoph Waltz was Franz Oberhauser, but really everyone going in was sort of expecting him to be Blofeld, and it did turn out to be Blofeld by the end. And it was just like, you could have just said it to begin with, you know, you didn't need to hide it in a similar way that John Harrison was actually Khan and stuff like that. It was like, everyone knows who he's going to be, you know, you're not fooling anyone. But yeah, no, I mean, you know, you have to say, you know, there's been, you know, 25 of them or whatever. I mean, I said that Roger Moore was my Bond, but was, I guess, because I'm slightly older than you, I'm just wondering, who was your introduction to Bond? Was it sort of, was it Dalton? Or, I mean, those were actually sort of like 15s in the cinema. So I'm wondering, was it actually Brosnan that was your introduction to them? Or?
Yes and no. Maybe a very specific 90s kid here, but I was born in 87, so the Dalton era, who I consider Dalton possibly my favourite James Bond. Well, the Brosnan era was the Bond era that I really got into. You know, I was desperate to see Tomorrow Never Dies at the cinema before the 12A era came. I was 10. I prayed, I begged, I did anything I could to go see that movie at the cinema, but I had to make do with Blockbuster. So it was 1999 before I got the chance to see a Bond movie in the cinema with the very underrated The World Is Not Enough. But for 90s kids that listen on along, they might recognise James Bond Jr. I love that program. It was about James Bond's nephew who went to like this high school with like brains, who was like Q's nephew or something like that, and they go on all these adventures against, it's not Spectre, it's Scum, and you know, Jaws is in it, you know, Dr. No, all these sorts of people pop up in it. It was such a batty TV show that I wish if it was released on DVD or digital tomorrow, I would buy it. It was one of the best things of my childhood, and you know, it was impossible not to have easy access to Bond movies on like terrestrial TV as a kid. So, you know, Brosnan movies were my gateway, but you know, I enjoyed Roger Moore quite a bit as a kid. You know, I grew out of that quite quickly as I grew older, but it was always a thing every Christmas, you know, with a bit of Christmas money, Bond movies would be like buy one get one free on VHS. So I was always like, every couple of years I was adding to my collection and being able to dive into some of the older movies as I went along.
And I guess you've probably had to upgrade your collection ever since, from VHS to DVD to Blu-ray and then a new box set comes out, but then a new movie comes out and you've got to get another box set.
Yeah, well, I bought the 50th anniversary box set a couple of years ago, so that went up to Skyfall. So that was a nice way to end it. So I've picked up all the Blu-rays since, and I think it was quite cheap to buy on digital on a sale last year, so I own all of the movies on digital as well. So it's quite easy to just switch them on and activate it from there. So yeah, I have bought Bond, you know, individual DVDs, Blu-rays, box sets. Yeah, I've been a total mark for it over the years. God knows how much money I've pumped into Bond. But, you know, I think for thinking about this film, it's, I think it's easier to break it down into little chunks and maybe talk about certain sections. And, you know, some of this will bleed into to other parts, but I want to kind of know, you know, obviously we are going to dive into spoilers here because you don't listen to a James Bond podcast without sort of signing up for that kind of deal. But I want to know, what was your reaction when you walked out of the cinema on the Thursday evening? Did you enjoy it? Did you have mixed expectations? How did that movie land for you?
I mean, I had a great time watching it. I liked the way that it sort of went at the end. I thought it lagged a bit in the middle. I thought the opening was fantastic. I came out thinking someone's got a hard on for the end of The Dark Knight Rises, that's for sure. And we'll get onto that in a bit. But yeah, no, overall, I thought it was a good movie. Not, I think I still would rate Casino Royale and Skyfall higher, but I thought it was a nice, probably one of the best routes that they could have gone down in terms of tying up Daniel Craig's era in a nice little wrapped bow. I do have a theory that we could get into, that it might not be, the ending might not be what we think it is, but we can get onto that. But overall, yeah, no, I was satisfied. I did think it didn't need to be 163 minutes long. But I think I would still be keen to watch it again to see how it plays out, knowing how it ends, to watch it through again. And also, I thought that some of the action scenes were fantastic. But one of the most interesting things I thought was actually Hans Zimmer's score, which I didn't seem to notice too much. But then, sort of thinking back on it, there was some really nice sort of motifs and stuff like that. It was just interesting to see how someone who you know so well from reinventing other musical characters, such as, you know, a new Superman theme, new Batman theme, stuff like that, how he wove in just different elements of the Bond, created some new stuff, but also, you know, put in the classic sort of moments that you do expect as well. So I thought that was quite interesting.
Yeah, Hans Zimmer didn't stand out too much for me either. I thought he did a good score. I think there was definitely parts where it sounded a bit like the Dark Knight soundtrack in places. I mean, I've the one thing that's disappointed me a little bit about the film, you know, if I was up, is like I remember when I heard it last year, the Billie Eilish song "No Time to Die." It's okay. It's not the bombastic movie, you know, Skyfall kind of tune, or a Casino Royale, or, you know, a classic, you know, like we got with someone like Nobody Does It Better or GoldenEye, etc. It's just a very forgettable song, and I don't remember anything about those James Bond opening credits. You know, a little bit of mix of some of the previous stuff that had gone on, but, you know, pretty uninspired. So, you know, I was kind of hoping for a bit more from Hans Zimmer, but I think, again, it's one of those things, I think I need to go in and watch that a second time. And
yeah, I know, I agree about the Billie Eilish song. Is it bad that I'd completely forgotten that that song was actually released last year? That's how forgettable it was. I was like going, oh, this guy sounds kind of familiar. I was like, oh yeah, they actually had released it like in like February or March before the film was meant to come out. And I was like, oh yeah. And for the credits, yeah, I mean, there's some guns firing that form into DNA and stuff, because there's always sort of little hints at the plot and stuff like that. But yeah, it's certainly no, you know, GoldenEye destroying, you know, Cold War statues, and or even like the, I think the ones in Casino Royale are fantastic with the use of the playing cards and stuff like that. So yeah, it's not the best, but it's certainly better than I think Writing on the Wall for me.
Yeah, so I kind of left the film, I liked it. One thing that stood out big time for me was, I know a lot of people have said, like, obviously, last chance, because we're going to dive into the biggest spoiler of the lot here, but, like, I remember seeing some of the reviews and like reactions from the day before from the press screening, and usually I do not read those things or go anywhere near them, but I thought, you know what, I'm going to have a read of a couple of reviews, and obviously I knew it had been spoiled by The Guardian last year, inexplicably, that Bond had a daughter in this movie that hadn't even been hinted at in any of the trailers, footage, anything like that. So that
was that
me.
What the Guardian spoiler was? I managed to go the entire time without reading that. I'm impressed.
That was the daughter. And obviously they got a shitstorm for that and so on. I was pissed off. But I saw people said that they found the ending a bit emotional. I didn't, and I'm someone that enjoys a good cry. So obviously they do it. They kill James Bond. And I think what my problem with that bit that didn't make it land as much is that I think it's a film of two halves that work really well. They don't seem to kind of click too well. I think the whole thing about Bond coming back and, you know, meeting up with this new 007, Naomi, I think that was her name, and I find that really, really interesting. And Bond coming sort of out of retirement, back into the game, you know, I don't really buy into the relationship between him and Madeleine Swann. I just don't feel it. But I thought that stuff was interesting. It was quite personal, very different from the James Bond world. But I found the whole plot with Rami Malek's villain, like, really odd and at times boring. And I found him quite difficult. And I watched this on an IMAX speakers to make out some of the things that were going on. I know the bit where, like, in the climax of the movie where, like, Safran shoots, like, Bond and so on. And then he injects him with this, like, poison and stuff like that. I didn't even notice, like, the injection of the poison, and it was just like, oh wait, that just happened, okay, right. It just felt like it just, that whole plot line, I never quite got what was going on. Like, I know that they were, like, planning to obviously release these nanobots and turn it against them, but I never quite bought into it of like, oh, how is this working? How are they deploying it? You know, it just always felt a bit confusing, and they just felt like there was this stop clock that just wasn't there that you get with some maybe other Bond movies. And kind of I spent that whole bit where they were like, oh, they are actually going to kill him. And I was really respecting the film for doing that. But I just thought, oh, what happened there? I didn't quite, it seemed to happen really quickly, and I kind of just lost a bit of track of it. And I just found that whole plot line really a bit confusing. And even like with that American spy agent Ash, I didn't even know what really was going on with him. He just seemed to pop up in a couple of scenes, and I don't really know what he was necessarily up to in Norway either, or his motivations. All that stuff was just really underwritten.
Yeah, no, for me the Logan Ash story line probably could have been cut completely. I think, you know, it does leave, it leads to a more emotional moment in the sort of first half with, because this is a spoiler one, the death of Felix Leiter, who's you know, been a mainstay in the Craig era the whole way. But I think that sort of section in Norway where, with the whole sort of car chase, I think that's one action scene that I probably could have done without. It could have just sort of been, they wake up, have breakfast, but then, you know, Bond gets, you know, a dart in the neck or something, and then he wakes up and they've been kidnapped and he has to go do his thing, you know. I think, yeah, there wasn't, I think Billy Magnussen is someone who, he just didn't feel right in the role. I watched another movie recently called The Survivor, where he plays meant to be like an evil Nazi, which is meant to be aiming for sort of Ralph Fiennes in Schindler's List level of evil, but it doesn't come across that way whatsoever. So I think he was kind of miscast in that role. But I know exactly what you mean about the Safran plotline. You know, it's got an excellent beginning with the creepy sort of silent sort of sort almost sort of horror element where he comes to and stalks someone around the house and things like that. But the biggest issue for me was the lack of motivation as to what his plan was. You know, I know every, but maybe they're trying to, you know, go against the cliches and not have Bond villains continuously monologuing their plot and whatever. But yes, they're developing this nanobot technology which can be targeted to kill someone by encoding their DNA in it. but he never really says why they're doing it or who they're wanting to target and what's the end game. It's like, who are they trying to get rid of and whatever. You know, Thanos in Marvel, which is someone who was also wanting to wipe out a lot of the human race, but he was basically saying that, you know, the world's overpopulated, you know, everyone's going to die unless I do something. But we never really find out what Safin's end game was. I mean, for all the... You know, I know there's a whole other issue about the sort of facial scarring, and, you know, Bond's villains have always had some sort of facial disfiguration, which, you know, is a shorthand for, oh, look, this person's evil because they're missing an eye or scarred or something. But I think that he just didn't have enough screen time. He was very absent and therefore didn't feel like a credible threat. Having said that, he is someone who basically in the end was able to hurt Bond more than any other villain, actually, you know, not physically, but he had the vial that had the DNA encoded to Madeline and the daughter as well, and basically it can be transmitted to someone via gas, aerosol, could be breathed in or within contact from the skin. So that's how it was transferred onto Bond. It basically, he got the blood on them, and then he was basically, if he was ever in contact with Madeline and the daughter again, they would die, so because they're connected by the DNA. So basically it was put him in the impossible position that he cannot see the person that he loves ever again, so he decides to, rather than live without them, he decides to sacrifice himself and stay on the island. And again, credit to them for seeing that through. It's my one criticism of the Dark Knight Rises is I really thought that they would kill off Batman, but then they kind of do this sort of little bit of fake out at the end and make you think that Bruce Wayne is still alive in there. So they do kill him off, and they have that slightly awkward scene where Ray finds his M is reading from a book and they're all having a whiskey, which did feel like a ripoff of the Dark Knight Rises. But I have a theory that it isn't the end. You know, you could, if you so wished, imagine a happy ending, because there is that slightly awkward moment. If you do stay to the end of the credits, you get the traditional sort of James Bond will return, which does seem like an odd thing to say, given that you have killed him off. And I guess we'll talk about this at the end, about where I guess we imagine the franchise is going to go. But nanobots are essentially sort of microorganisms which are robotic in nature. They have artificial intelligence, and they do require a power source. Doing some reading on them, a lot of them basically use an electrical charge which is created by the body, but they have an electric charge. Now, Bond, one of the gadgets he's given at the end by Q is a watch that can emit an electromagnetic pulse. The only use of this in the final action sequence is to basically blow up the electronic eye, which is in one of the henchmen, which seems like, you know, there's a thousand ways that he could have killed him and done a funny quip to do it that way. I mean, it seems slightly extreme, but they never use it again. So I had a theory coming out at the end that he could technically use the electromagnetic charge in the watch to fry the nanobots, and therefore eliminating them from his system, they would be defunct and no longer dangerous. Of course, there's the issue of the fact that he was on an island which was getting bombed, but maybe he got, you know, blown up off the roof into the sea, where he was then able to wake up, swim to safety, obviously then patch himself up from, I think, at least two gunshots, which had probably gone, I think it was an entry and an exit wound. So, you know, he's probably done that several times. So he probably would be fine.
He did it in Skyfall. That's the exact beginning of Skyfall.
So there is a chance that he could have potentially survived. I mean, what they had done is, if they hadn't blown him up on the island, if you're listening to this and haven't seen it, it's your own fault by now. It was a way of potentially writing out Madeline and the daughter from not appearing on screen, because he has to stay away from them and he's too heartbroken by it never to mention them again. But I guess it all depends on where they go forward. So, I mean, do you think that that's potential? It just seemed a little odd to introduce this electromagnetic pulse watch and then only use it once to fry somebody's eyeball. It felt a bit, with all the gadgets and stuff that have been introduced in Bond films, normally have a big payoff, or so it just felt a little out of place to me that was the only reason for it to be there.
I think with the watch, like, I think they do use it another time when they're breaking onto the island or something like that to shock
the cameras. Yeah,
I think there's a bit of that, but I think it's one of those things. I think they purposely didn't make it vague. Like, you literally see him being vaporized. So I think it's almost meant to leave it that there's no way back. It is the end of the line. And I love that it did say, you know, James Bond will return. And it was quite funny. I was in a work meeting earlier today and a couple of us were chatting about having seen the new James Bond movie and a couple people still to see it. And one of the people that hadn't seen it went, and I can't believe they killed James Bond. Like, they did not know the ending, but they were just saying that to try and make a fake spoiler to throw off a coworker. So someone is going to get in trouble when they see that movie and they're going to be like, actually, that person did spoil it for me if they think that was real. But
yeah. If you haven't seen it, actually, then I would avoid Twitter, because if you type in James Bond on Twitter, then it automatically fills in auto search James Bond dies at the end.
Oh my gosh.
Like, so yeah, be wary of spoilers. But again, you're listening to this podcast, so it's your fault.
I think it's one of those ones, like, what I found, again, it's one of those things, like, I was taking it in, but then I had this wider picture at the time where I remembered all the chat at the time for Danny Boyle leaving was that he was determined that James Bond should die at the end of the movie and that the Broccoli's pushed back against that. And then when I was watching the film, I was like, oh, so either that rumor wasn't true or they took that part and still built from it. I was amazed that this film has been locked for 18 plus months now and that never got leaked at all, like how this film was going to end. I think that is an incredible testament to the crew, especially when you think of how, you know, the daughter plotline leaked.
Yeah, no, I mean, there was a lot of things in here that had potential to be ruined by, and I guess they are being ruined by over enthusiastic audiences here in the UK. You know, they might be spoiling it for the US in the same way that the US are currently spoiling Venom, Let There Be Carnage for UK audiences. I think it's safe to say that one of those outranks the other in terms of what would be considered a spoiler, but you never know. But yeah, no, I mean, the fact that they managed to keep so much of it under wraps, I think is like you say, is a testament. It's probably up there with The Mandalorian and the fact that nobody leaked the fact that there was Baby Yoda in it. You know, they managed to get to the, you know, the end of the first episode before people realised what was going on. It was like, yeah, it's a testament to the, and, you know, a testament to Daniel Craig that, you know, this was, you know, he wanted to come back for another one, and it's great to see that it ended on his terms and in what felt like a Harrison Ford Han Solo-esque full stop on his tenure.
Yeah, I got that impression as well. I mean, it's always something actors seem to love, coming back for one final movie to get the chance to kill off an iconic character. It's not often you can get an opportunity like that. I think this one was a bit more successful than the Force Awakens killing. But yeah, I think it was a really brave choice, and I respect them a lot. I mean, it's not significant in the grand scheme of things, killing off a main character at the end of a franchise, but the fact that so few of them can do it and have the courage to do that impresses me a lot.
Yeah, and I mean, technically, one could argue that it was hinted at the very beginning with the use of All the Time in the World from Her Majesty's Secret Service, which famously, you know, ends with the death of Bond's wife. So, I mean, a lot of people might have been thinking that, oh gosh, here we go again. They're going to kill off Bond's girlfriend at the end. However, they flipped it, and it was the woman left behind after seeing her love betrothed evaporate on an island. So.
Yeah, and especially after all the women that have died in Bond or people that have sacrificed themselves for Bond, it felt fitting that finally someone else should take the shot and so on. And I thought it was done. It was a nice, sweet moment, but it does feel like a little bit rushed afterwards. You almost have this like 3 minutes left of the movie after that. There doesn't feel like there's that bit of maybe breathing room where I liked it at the end of, say, The Dark Knight Rises. I wish they'd killed off Batman, but I felt like with that there was like, you know, it just ties the threads a little bit together just to sort of see the impact that this man's death has had, as opposed to maybe just a quiet word from a book of poetry, a clink of the whiskey, and then someone offer a wee drive in Italy. It just felt like there just needed to be just a little bit more just to process what had happened and to reflect on that run.
Yeah, no, I think with The Dark Knight Rises, I always felt it should have ended like 2 seconds earlier, just like with the Michael Caine giving the nod. But then you never needed to see the other side of that shot of Bruce and Selena enjoying an Aperol Spritz or whatever it is in Florence. So yeah, I mean, at least they didn't go down the roots of, you know, like a cheesy thing with Nomi being reinstated as 007 or, you know, setting up the future of the franchise. It allowed that this sort of moment to tie up and leave it as it is before any potential for an MCU style multiverse with spin-offs for the new 007 in Nomi, or as many people seem to be clamoring for a Paloma spin-off with Ana de Armas. I mean, what's your thoughts on the Cuba sequence? I mean, I think a lot of people are saying it's like their favourite action set piece in the film and they wanted more of her. But I mean, I think it was just like a perfect one shot, you know, in and done. You know, he was very impressed with her on the set of Knives Out and had wanted to work with her. So, I mean, do you think that that scene was always as it was, or do you think it was maybe rewritten? Because in some ways it feels like he could have just gone into that party on his own. He didn't need an escort. So I'm just wondering, do you think that feels like it was maybe rewritten to bring her in? And I'm keen to get your thoughts on Phoebe Waller-Bridge's you know, work on the screenplay. Do you have any ideas of where she was able to work her magic?
Yeah, so I like the Cuba scene quite a lot. I think it was probably maybe expanded a little bit. I know that, I suppose, the joy of Daniel Craig being a co-producer in this film gives him a bit more sway to go, actually, I want this person cast. And I thought it was an inspired choice. I thought that scene and character was a highlight. And I'm okay with it being like a 10-15 minute scene of them. You know, there's enough characters in this that need to breathe, and, you know, there's enough things that can maybe be cut down. But I think that had the right amount of time in it, so I was happy with that. And for Phoebe Waller-Bridge, I really like Fleabag, especially like the first season of Killing Eve. You know, what a fantastic spy show that was, about MI6 and agents, etc. But I didn't really see much of her influence on it. I think that might be something I'll maybe pick up on multiple viewings, maybe. But I didn't... There was maybe like a few jokes or witticisms here and there that I thought, oh, that must be a Phoebe Waller-Bridge moment. But nothing that... too impactful, I suppose. Her role was to come in and, you know, do a bit of a polish on the script, so her involvement is probably still quite limited. She's probably a bit more famous than most kind of additional writers are, but yeah, I didn't really pick up on much. I kind of hoped for a little bit more. I would have maybe liked her to have been maybe involved from the beginning of the process, the writing development, as opposed to maybe coming in when that script is maybe like 90% done, or it's just looking to have a draft 2 or 3 done to it.
Yes, I mean, what did you make of... Because I was wondering if she did have an influence on the character Bond, because what I did notice, and this one is... And I know some moron on the internet complaining about how woke Bond is now, and the fact that he only sleeps with one person in the film, and that's with the person who he was in a committed relationship with for a long time. You know, he has a bit of mild flirtation with... Paloma about, you know, taking his pants off or whatever, and then he's like, oh no, I need you to just put on a tux. Or how he gets sort of shot down nearly literally by Nomi. You know, she's the one almost basically playing him, as he would normally play the females in the role of being a double agent and stuff like that. So it was interesting to see him evolve that way. I mean, what did you make of his... I mean, he's got obviously got a very high kill count as always, but a very low bed count.
Yeah, I think it's been kind of par for the course in his era. I mean, sort of in Casino Royale, he kind of fools around with that mobster's partner. He obviously he sleeps with Vesper. Quantum of Solace doesn't have... I think maybe he has... Does he have sex with Strawberry Fields?
I think he does, yeah.
Skyfall... He maybe, I think the assumption is he maybe got a blowjob or something like that after he got his shave. But, you know, we don't really see him have sex in that either. Spectre, you know, obviously he hooks up with Madeline Swan and then into this one. So it's kind of...
Did he hook up with Monica Bellucci after her husband was killed?
They made out a little bit and then he pissed off to go to the Spectre meeting. But that's happened. Like, the, you know, the Dalton era was very aware of, like, say it was like the AIDS epidemic at the time, and didn't want to have a freewheeling shagger of a Bond, so they kept him quite, you know, not very sexual. So, like, it happens in Bond, the idea that it's an easy thing to assume that Bond is always like that, but there is always periods of time where that's not the case. And I think, you know, it's always about matching Bond with interesting kind of female characters, and, you know, people like M, you know, being elevated in status and appearance wise, you know, some of these characters being drawn out a little bit more, you know, that's always a bit more interesting than the sexual scenes and so on, which you always kind of get the impression maybe happened off camera while he's, you know, doing what he's doing or on retirement duty.
Yeah, and I mean, so do you think there's any future for these other characters? Because I was trying to remember, was Nomi ever outed as 007 in the press beforehand? Because I noticed watching back on the trailers and stuff like that, she's always referred to as, you know, I met your new 00. But I know that was there an outcry that the fact that she was going to be 007, I couldn't remember if it had been confirmed or not that she was taking his number.
Never been official, but it had been alluded to, and I kind of assumed it was as well. And, you know, for better or worse, it's a good way to get it up some of the people that were like complaining about, like, you can't have a James Bond that's black or a woman and stuff like that. I go, well, you know, it's a bit of the best of both worlds. It is a bit token representation, but I thought she was a fantastic character. I really loved those pairings together. But I was slightly annoyed, I mean, when, you know, in sort of towards the climax of the film, when they're both working together, you know, M, Q, etc., always dialing into Bond, you know, when he's given back 007. And, you know, it's like, well, you've got two 00s in the field. You know, you can know 007, 008, you know, how are things going? You know, it's almost like she's a bit of her power is taken away from her in those moments, which I thought was a little bit disappointing.
Yeah, and I mean, I wasn't a fan of her quip at the end when she sort of killed the scientist, when she goes, what time is it? And it's time to die. And it's like, and I'm like, no, the film's title is called No Time to Die. I mean, I thought it was just a missed opportunity. I felt she needs to work on her quips.
Yeah, the one person I'd love to give a huge shout out to the film, and it was one of the huge improvements on Spectre, which I think is a very ugly looking film, the cinematography was poor on it, is Linus Sandgren, who did La La Land, First Man. I thought this film looked lovely, you know, the dusks, you know, the sunrises, etc. This film had a lot of colour in it, and you know, obviously everyone thinks that the Deacon's Point is a real high point for the franchise in terms of his cinematography, but I thought this was a real return to form after what I saw wonderfully described as the piss filter on Spectre being removed.
Yeah, no, I think there's a couple of just fantastic shots just on their own. I think the shot in the missile silo with all the guys in their sort of radioactive hazmat suits with the sort of lights coming out from the pool of whatever radioactive evil goo that they're cooking up or whatever. I think some of those shots were just really sort of fantastic. And yeah, the sort of use of natural light and stuff in the Italian sort of sequences as well was really good. And yeah, no, very impressed with the cinematography. It's certainly definitely one of the best looking Bond films of recent years. Well, I say recent years, it's quite a broad statement given the length of time between the last two. So
kind of, is there any parts that you want to give a shout out to, or parts that you thought had maybe kind of been a bit underserved?
Well, there's one point which I don't know how it was in your screening, but it elicited a few guffaws in my screening, and this is nothing to do with the film. It's not their fault, because it was wrapped up in like 2019. But any time that Tanner or M mentioned the fact that the PM is on the phone or I need to brief the PM, just imagining Boris Johnson on the other end of the line, it just seemed utterly ridiculous. A, he wouldn't have any idea what was going on. He wouldn't be able to help whatsoever. And it just seemed a bit odd to me that and again, it's not their fault. It's just who we have in charge at the moment. And yeah, so I mean, I don't know if they felt if they could have maybe erased those lines, and it would have been a more coherent film. But it just took me out of the film slightly whenever they mentioned the PM.
Well, remember, Margaret Thatcher appears in a James Bond movie, well, oh, kind of the back of her head. So, you know, it's definitely one of these things. Like, it always makes you, like, I think even in Skyfall, Mallory's like, you know, the PM, he likes to prattle on in a crisis. So, yeah, it always seems, you can't help but go, oh, God, yeah, it brings you back into the real world a little bit sometimes. Yeah, I think overall it's been a, you know, looking back on the Craig era, I think it's been highs and lows. I mean, for me, it would be Skyfall, Casino Royale as like the top tier. Then No Time to Die. Then Quantum of Solace. and then Spectre Bottom. Quantum of Solace isn't that great, but it's like just shy of 19, just shy of like just being over 90 minutes, which is a nice manageable total. Every time I watch Spectre, I think, oh, the beginning sort of 40 minutes is not too bad. It's got some good bits. I like the Spectre meeting. And then it's just always kind of just drones on for about, you know, a good nearly 2 hours afterwards, which is just a real struggle to get through. I can't imagine rewatching that again anytime soon. But I think overall it's been a really interesting experience to have had such a long James Bond experience that I've lived through. From, I remember the whole, you know, controversy at the start about Daniel Craig being chosen. I was actually
James Bond.
Yeah, and the website at the time, you know, Blonde, Not Bond or whatever. You know, I liked Craig. I had seen him in Layer Cake. I'd seen him in Enduring Love. Those sorts of things sold me on him. I was keen for it, and, you know, Bond needed a refresh at the time. And, you know, it's always been good to look forward to this every couple of years. So I'm ready for whatever comes next, and I think it could be interesting. Whoever the cast, I mean, my personal hope is that they do a couple of maybe one-off retro Bond films, like 60s-style Bond movies. You know, do something a little bit different. You know, I think they've got to pull back a little bit again from sort of the end of the world doomsday disaster. I think that's, you know, Bond always does that. It goes big, then it pulls back, and I think that wave, you know, is going to happen again here.
Yeah, well, I mean, you just have to look at the evolution of Daniel Craig from his first appearance as Bond, you know, coming down the Thames wearing his safety life jacket, and then his sort of final publicity shot of being an actual commander in the Royal Navy wearing his nice blue sweater. So that was nice to see. But I mean, there's been a thing like going around the Twitter and stuff like that over the weekend, you know, asking for people's favourite Bond stuff. So I'm just going to quickly go with you and ask you, but I think you've already answered the first one. So best movie, Daniel, these are Daniel Craig only ones. So best movie, you're saying Casino Royale?
Yeah, no, Skyfall.
Oh, Skyfall.
Skyfall, then Casino Royale.
Cool. Best villain or henchman?
Best villain, Le Chief, and the best hench person, ooh. Hench people haven't been that memorable really in this series. Maybe the guy, it's a recency bias, but the guy with the electric eye was all interesting. I just don't think they've had that good, you know, mini villains and stuff like that. So yeah, I probably have to pick him.
Okay, yeah, no, I'm going Le Chief for villain, and then for henchman, I'm going to go Hinks. Because I think Batista, he was someone that I wanted to see more of, so go with that. Best Bond girl?
Vesper Lynd.
Vesper Lynd for me too.
Ava Green was so good.
Yeah. Best opening credit sequence?
Skyfall. It's beautiful. Like the song, the imagery, it was just, I could watch that over and over again. And I have numerous times just been bored in my flat and went, shove on the Skyfall credit sequence and watch that on YouTube. I think it looks stunning, but Casino Royale is a close second.
So I'm assuming best song would be?
Skyfall.
Best cold open?
Casino Royale.
Yep, Casino Royale for me as well. Actually, with the opening, the change to the gun barrel with the blood, do you think that's just like a going with the times PC thing? What do you think the change was there with having the blood dripping down?
I think it just made for an easier cut to, you know, this white background. I think it's one of the things, like, I'm a traditionalist. The gun barrel should always be at the star. And I love how they did with Casino Royale. I was really annoyed that they put the one at the end of Quantum of Solace. There's no real reason for that. I'm fine with what they did at Skyfall, putting at the end and then cutting into sort of the 50th anniversary logo. Spectre, fine at the beginning. And then I wish it had kind of gone in and then opened up on the Mexico scene as opposed to this like title thing saying the dead have spoken or whatever. And then with this one,
Palpatine has returned.
Yeah, I was fine enough with that one, but it was just kind of like, again, you overthink these things, going, oh, there's no blood, okay, right, on to the next bit. So I think they've played around so much with the Bond gun barrel, sometimes really well, Casino Royale, and sometimes not so well, Quantum of Solace.
Cool. And going forward, I mean, obviously, we've kind of got, like they say, the full stop on the end of Craig's tenure. But then at the end, it does say James Bond will return. Are they going to have to essentially, do you think, wipe the slate clean and go back to the beginning? Because, you know, obviously, Bond's one started with becoming a 00 and then ends up with him saving the world and sacrificing himself to save the world. Do they almost have to reboot and start afresh, or do you think the new Bond will be in the middle of his tenure or something like that? How do you think they're gonna? It's a difficult one to address, I guess, especially with stuff like the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where there is such a big continuity these days. It's going to be interesting to see how they do it. And go and put your money where your mouth is. Who do you want as a new James Bond?
Bond can always get away with it. I think it'll be a new Bond, but you know, whether they do it in the 60s or they do it modern day, it will be a kind of soft reboot. Ben Whishaw, M will be all there, you know, Q, all the people that we've got at the moment will by and large be there, as opposed to wiping the slate clean with all the sidekicks and so on like that. Like, I think people are really open to just it being like a Bond thing where it's like, oh yeah, that new guy's gone, but you know what, these characters all just kind of carry on and stuff like that. So I think that will be fine. I've said for years since I saw The Guest that Dan Stevens would make a fantastic Bond. I'm really keen on Dev Patel as well. I think when you watch a movie like The Wedding Guest, which I caught maybe 3-4 years ago at Glasgow Film Festival, and just the way he has grown as like a leading man, you know, his looks, I think Dev Patel is a fantastic potential option as well of doing something a little bit different, aka not having a white Bond and so on. I think he would very much fill the category of someone I'd be really interested to see. What about for yourself?
I think it'd be interesting to see how they tackle it. I mean, I was always of the opinion that, I mean, Skyfall ruined my theory in the fact that they directly address the fact that James Bond's name is James Bond. And I was wondering, I'd always wondered if, considering we've gone sort of, was it 5 or 6 different versions of Bond? And I mean, there was only sort of one kind of hint to it where, you know, George Lazenby opens His Majesty's Secret Service and says, well, this never happened to the other fellow. So, I mean, I always thought that if they'd kind of kept it as not referring to, if it wasn't his real name, James Bond could have been a code name for 007, because it always felt a bit odd that he kept announcing himself. You know, he's this world famous spy, yet he keeps announcing himself to everyone. You know, I thought spies were meant to keep their identity secret, but never mind. So the fact that they have directly addressed the fact that James Bond is a person's name and not, but I mean, maybe they could. Maybe they will give the name of James Bond as a code name to someone else. I don't know. Perhaps they will. Keep the legend alive. And I did see someone say that they would prefer to have a, I think it was Rami Malek said he'd like to see a Scottish Bond again. So I'm going to throw a name in the hat and let's go with Jack Loudon. I think
Jack Loudon is, I think he could stand a really good shout.
He's sort of young enough that he could carry the franchise for a good sort of 10-15 years, and yeah, I think he could. I think he could do the job. He's not well known enough that he wouldn't have a lot of baggage coming into the role, and I think he could be a good show. But yeah, I think Dan Stevens is another popular choice. I think it was similar to you. I think ever since The Guest came out, it was like, yeah, no, this guy's got potential. It's a shame that the rest of Hollywood hasn't really seen it yet or woken up to it yet.
Well, when he gets cast as a new Bond, you can write a think piece for your website of like the movies to check out, and we can really hammer home The Guest. You can imagine being like Layer Cake was at the time, a huge spike in people checking out that movie if it comes to pass, or maybe The Wedding Guest for Dev Patel. Who knows? I guess we'll just have to monitor it as the years to come.
Well, we should go put a bet on now so we get good odds at the moment.
Yes. Well, thank you very much to everyone for listening. We're going to take a bit of a mini break for a couple of weeks. We'll be off as I head to the London Film Festival and Dallas gets to enjoy it from the comfort of his home. And we'll touch base in a couple of weeks to share our reactions to a return to the film festival. So thanks very much for listening and goodbye.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.